In a moment, Julian Thankton tells us what it was like to voyage to Antarctica while researching his book about what the Belgica expedition was getting into at the end of the world, at the end of the 19th century. We'll also see what trees can teach us as changing climate conditions speed up their migration into new territories. And it's been a popular retreat since Roman times. Friends who live in Italy's Lake District describe the region's appeal, just an hour away from the bustle and hustle of Milan. Antarctica. It's captured the imagination of authors, explorers, and scientists for ages. It's one of the most hostile and remote locations on Earth, and now it's emerging as a tourist destination. Writer Julian Thankton visited Antarctica to research an ill-fated Belgian expedition there back in 1897 for his book Madhouse at the End of the Earth, the Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. He joins us today to talk about his experience, the ins and outs of visiting such an extreme location, and the ethical question of whether to go at all. Julian, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, can you give us just a brief overview of your experience in Antarctica? What got you interested in, and why did you go down there?
Well, I was researching what would become my book, Madhouse at the End of the Earth, about, as you say, an expedition in the late 19th century to the Antarctic Peninsula and to the Bellingshausen Sea. And while I didn't want to replicate everything about their expedition, certainly not the being trapped in ice for more than a year and the descent into madness, I did feel like it was essential to travel there myself in order to convey the sights and sounds and smells of this continent and really render this setting in three dimensions.
Okay, now the Belgica was 1897, and this was during a period when it seems like there was a rush of interest in, you know, polar expeditions. Give us a brief overview of the history of exploration of Antarctica.
Captain James Cook in the late 18th century was the first to see it. He didn't actually venture there. The first time anybody landed on Antarctica was in 1820. Then came whalers and sealers, one expedition in the middle of the 19th century, and then it was really not much at all until the Belgica expedition. And that kicked off what is now known as the heroic age of Antarctic exploration. Many of your listeners will have heard of Ernest Shackleton, Robert Falcon Scott, and Roald Amundsen, who, as I should mention, was a first mate on the Belgica before discovering the South Pole. All of those were the great heroes of this age. After a while, it became less of a playing ground for a sportsmanlike contest to reach these great exploits and became something of interest to scientists who established bases, who up until World War II and shortly after were also looking into, you know, establishing military bases there. But then after 1959 and the signing of the Antarctic Treaty, which forbade military activity and encouraged international scientific cooperation on the continent, there started to be a trickle of tourists, a trickle of people who wanted to see this for themselves. And what became a few hundred every year grew to a few thousand visitors to Antarctica. And by the time I went at the end of the last decade, there were 55,000 tourists
per year
in a given year.
Wow. What is there now as far as permanent buildings and bases? Is it nobody lives there other than scientists? Is that right?
Scientists and support personnel. There is a very small number of people living there year-round, and they're a hardy group, let me tell you. There are people at the South Pole Station, which is jointly operated by a number of
Actually on the South Pole?
Actually on the South Pole, yeah.
Wow.
And believe it or not, they're studying the effects of long-term isolation there in order to create a model for Martian exploration, because that's how remote it is.
Do they just fly in? Is there a little airstrip there?
Yeah, you would have to fly or chopper in, but you can only really, even if there's an emergency, you can't extract people for a good part of the year, because that's how hostile an environment is. I mean, the temperature dips down to, you know, minus 60, if I'm not mistaken, if not more.
Right. So there's scientists living there. Is there also is there some land, or is it just ice locked?
Well, the difference between the Arctic and the Antarctic is that the Arctic is an ocean of ice with, you know, a few islands, of course. But for the most part, when you're on the North Pole and you stay there, you're not going to be on the North Pole for long because it's constantly drifting. Whereas the Antarctic, and this was unknown until the first few years of the 20th century, the Antarctic is one solid continent. And when you're on the South Pole, you are standing on about a mile's worth of ice, but it's on top of land.
Wow. So you're 5,000 or more feet above sea level, and it's basically all ice. I guess it's mountains and ice on top of that. Yep.
Exactly. It's the highest, driest, windiest, coldest land on Earth. It is absolutely inimical to human life and beyond the coasts to life itself.
And if any place on the earth was going to not be owned by any country, perhaps this is a good place that way. Does this treaty actually
That's a good way to put it. You know, it's either a great optimistic moment for humanity to think that there's never been a war fought over it, or it's an acknowledgement of the fact that there's not much to fight over.
Travel writer and editor Julian Thankton took a tour to Antarctica to see with his own eyes what the crew of the first polar expeditions would have encountered. His book about the icebound voyage of the Belgica is called Madhouse at the End of the Earth. Julian's with us right now on Travel with Rick Steves for a deeper look at what he discovered about tourism to Antarctica. His website is juliansankton.com. So, Julian, if somebody wants to go there today as a tourist, as you said, 55,000 people would go in a normal year these days, how do you get there? Do you go down to South America and then take a ferry? I mean, I'm kind of kidding there, but are there cruises or do you fly in? Or what are these 55,000 people do to get there?
Well, there's various ways to get down. There are various access points. One is South America, which is the way I got there. One is South Africa, and one is, you know, New Zealand.
So these are jumping off points for ships or for planes then?
Well, for both. Up until recently, the way that tourists would get there, at least I'm most familiar with South America because that is the way that the men of the Belgica got there. They left from Ushuaia in Argentina.
And this was across Drake Passage, right?
Across the Drake Passage, which is
hundreds
of miles, of tumultuous waters, and it's notoriously nauseating. I did not feel that it was essential to go through the Drake Passage. I've got a friend who is an Antarctic tour guide who told me that it's, you know, the 2 days that it takes to cross the Drake Passage give you the sense of how remote this is and how separate it is from anything we would call normal life.
If you go through that, I mean, if you did, that would be a romantic and emotional way to approach. What would you experience? I mean, how do you know all of a sudden you're in the Antarctic? I mean, you talked about this Antarctic convergence and different seabirds and so on.
Yeah.
What's that first like, hey, welcome to the continent?
You would start seeing skuas, petrels. You know, you would see different species of penguin as opposed to the Magellanic penguin.
No polar bears, by the way. We got to remind people, polar bears should actually be called North Polar bears, right?
Yes. If you see a polar bear, then you're going the wrong way.
okay. But lots of penguins.
Yeah. Typically, there is a shroud of fog that has to do with there's this cold front coming from the Antarctic and the warm front coming from the north. And this makes it so that on a typical day, you would see Antarctica appear as through a mist, which is just an unbelievably romantic image.
That could be one of the great moments for travelers anywhere on this planet. We're talking with Julian Thankton. His book is Madhouse at the End of the Earth, The Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. And Julian, your book is so fascinating. It very well could inspire lots of people to want to travel to Antarctica. But there is an ethical issue. And when we think of Antarctica, we think also about, you know, the plight of our environment and the melting ice cap. Did you wrestle with that?
I really did.
What are the ethics of this?
I did wrestle with it. I always thought that it should be a place that remains sort of romantically inaccessible, that we should know that it's there and that that should be enough, that seeing it with your own eyes.
For the penguins and for the research scientists.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, my calculus changed when I started writing this book, and maybe it was self-serving, but it didn't mean that I didn't wrestle with the dilemma.
You're a reporter, you're working on it. There's scientists that are there. You know, there's certain cases, but mass tourism.
But for the average person,
You know, as we have privileged people who can afford to jet down there and go there, it does take its toll.
It does. You realize that even though the ecosystem looks quite similar to the way it did in the photographs from the expedition that I write about 120 years ago, it looks as if nothing has changed. But in fact, things have changed quite dramatically, even though they're not really visible. These changes are not visible to the naked eye. And one of the great things that most of these tour operators do is they have citizen science programs that, for those who are interested, you're able to go with their scientists on board and collect data with them. And the data, that's precious data, because, you know, not every scientific or academic or government institution is able to go down there as frequently as tour operators do. So they do actual real work. And you're able to be in the Zodiac with them and take water samples or, you know, study the health of the marine life. So one thing that a marine biologist made very clear to me is that the increased meltwater from the icebergs from the higher temperatures is decreasing the salinity of the water along the coast of the peninsula. And so that decreased salinity makes it a less hospitable environment for the phytoplankton that krill feast on. And the whole ecosystem depends on krill. And so when you realize that glaciers are melting at an increased rate, that whole ice shelves are breaking off. There's sections the size of Delaware that are suddenly breaking off. There's the threat that glaciers will start pouring into the sea and raise sea levels. That all weighs heavily on your mind. And you realize that the emissions that it took to get you and your shipmates there, let alone the emissions that I was responsible for because I flew over the Drake Passage, that does create a sense of guilt. I think it's impossible to see this landscape without mm-hmm. guilt.
Right. You know, that's an interesting takeaway, Julian, because more and more we have to struggle with the ethics of travel. And if you're going to go there, it's really an interesting option, but it comes with it some a little bit of thoughtfulness.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to make that choice to go to Antarctica, I think it's almost certain that it's going to change you in some way. They say to leave only footprints and take only photos, but I think you should also take with you a real sense of responsibility for preserving the beauty of this landscape that you've experienced and really become a warrior for the environment.
Yeah, that's my kind of souvenir. Julian Sankton, thank you so much for joining us and giving us a better understanding about Antarctica.
Thanks so much.
Julian Sankton tells us about the Belgica's Icebound Antarctic Expedition on Travel with Rick Steves program number 656. It's in our show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. Up next, Zach St. George explains why the forests are restless. And after that, we're off to northern Italy's scenic lake district.